Okay, welcome to the Arizona State Hospital IOC. It is December 19th and it's 6:02 and we're going to begin the meeting. Does anyone have, I'm going to call it to order. We want to establish our quorum. I know Chuck and I are here. Alice is here. Jane, Janina, Melissa, and Dee. Anyone else? Do you know if the units are going to call in? Because usually K is prompt.
I know that Tara went to each of the units to remind them. She is now on PTO, so hope or annual leave. So they should be joining. They were made aware.
Okay. Yeah, you have two patients here from Saguaro.
Okay, so let's go ahead and start. Before we begin, does anyone have a disclosure of conflict of interest? And if so, please state why. Hearing none, let's move on.
Lori, really quick. The folks on the call from Saguaro, could you please do us a favor and hit *6 to mute your phone? We're getting a little bit of an echo from you. And then when you want to talk, just hit *6 again to unmute.
Okay, gotcha.
Thank you. Has everyone had a chance to review the meeting minutes that Larry sent out promptly after our last meeting? And if so, do we have a motion to approve?
This is Alice, motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, any objections? No. All in favor?
Aye.
I don't see any other IOCs on. Are there any other IOCs other than the HASH members? Anyone else on? Okay, I don't hear any. Next was reviewing of action items. Anything from our ongoing discussions? Any updates? Okay, any, Mike, is there any update on the lack of resources to do risk assessments? Any movement there?
Nothing since the last time the group met. We did give the numbers to the governor's office for consideration to add a few psychologists to our team to accommodate the increased workload. I should have texted you about this, Lori. I apologize. I did upload the risk assessment checklist to the IOC folder per the vote of the last meeting of the IOC. So it is up there for review.
Okay. So for the IOC members, I'll send that out to you so you can see what the checklist entails, or if we have time, I can bring it up.
I'm curious. I'm sorry to interrupt. I know I don't have the little sign raise my hand. My understanding is there's still a lot of grant money floating around between now and the end of the year, although I know we're coming up on the end of the year, for various things. I don't know how to write grants or anything, but has anybody at the hospital looked at a potential grant to even get somebody in for a year to help, you know, with the risk assessment load?
So we haven't looked at grants for that specific purpose. The issue with those grants, obviously, like you just said, they're one-time funding and they expire at the end of the year. So when we look at things like this, we do our best. We really want to just have actual hospital employees and not a third-party independent consultant doing that work. And the reason for that is they may get called to testify. And if they testify after the grant expires, then we have no way of paying for them.
Oh, I understand. Okay, thanks.
Sometimes depends on the grant, but some grants can be multi-year. So that may be a thought too. Okay, Mike, do you have any?
I should take a grant writing class. I should learn because there's so much out there that you don't even realize, you know? Okay, sorry.
Do you have any update from ASH administration?
No, nothing since the last time the group met, Lori. This is the kind of the weird time of the year. Things kind of calm down. But we are just full steam ahead. This is what I like to call tour season at the hospital. So I've been doing probably two or three tours of the hospital a week to interested parties who want to come see the facility and get an idea for what we do and the role that we play in the system of care. And then obviously we're ready for the next legislative cycle to begin in just a few weeks. So just going to kind of relax for a little while and then jump headfirst into it.
Okay. Thanks. Larry, do you have any updates?
Good evening. No, it's Radio A tonight.
Okay. Have they hired the ombudsman from ADOA? Sorry.
As far as I'm aware, no. I know they're in the process of interviewing and looking at candidates now, but I have not got an update, a final update saying that somebody's been hired. I can certainly follow up with Tim on that to at least have an update before the next meeting. Whether they're hired or whether they're not hired. So I'll have an update for the committee next meeting.
Okay. Last I heard, Lori, is that ADOA was down to the final two candidates for vetting.
Oh, good. Okay, that sounds promising. I know, Alice, you and Barb went and did in-person visits. I don't think Barb is on unless she joined after this call started.
I'm not sure she's on yet. She'll be here.
Okay. I can go ahead and go over incident and accidents, and then maybe by that time she'll be on.
Probably, yeah. There you go.
Okay. The first one is ASH 2024-3612. And it was an assault. And with this time, I didn't have time to highlight the ones, but it seemed like someone was attacking both peers and staff and redirected. But they did, one of the persons did end up on the floor and did have a hematoma and a laceration. And they were sent out to the ER for evaluation for that. I'm trying to see why. Oh, this one, the reason why I pulled it was unusual is a patient was attacking a staff member. And because of that, another patient jumped in to help. And then they ended up getting in a fight. But I think I was reading that. I think we've seen this before where patients are told not to jump in, even though they have the best intention, but it sometimes ends up with additional injuries. But I think they did it because they were trying to help a staff member out. I'm up reading really quickly. Was for this one, was there any staff shortage at the time? Did that contribute to a patient having to jump in?
No, I don't believe so. We're staffed appropriately. I think this was just a matter of the patient where they were physically in the building at the time. They were by the telephones when one thing happened.
Okay. Okay. This one, the next one was ASH 2024-3648. And again, it was another assault, but this one without an injury. Oh, this one, again, they were attempting to view the video and it couldn't because it was not captured. This is lack of visitation or cameras in the visitation room. Have there been any thoughts that maybe that should be an area that is under observation?
They've been added to the new system.
Oh, good. Okay. Next one is Ash 2024-3648, another assault. And this one, again, it was a patient assaulting another patient. Usually I highlight them, sorry. There's a problem when I'm traveling. And it looked like they were trying to de-escalate a situation. No signs of injury. Trying to see why I pulled this. Again, this was, wait a second, was that the same one? Same one, sorry about that. It pasted twice. The next one is Ash 2024-3691. And this one was significant physical changes in a patient. A patient was, I'm trying to see how it won't disclose. This patient has an assistant, has some assisting equipment, and the patient apparently took part of the mechanism apart and swallowed screws before the staff could get to the patient. So then the patient was sent over to Valleywise and in the ER. And it was reported that even during the shift, the patient was threatening at Valleywise. Let's see. And also trying some significant self-harm while over at Valleywise, which was just a question. If someone swallows screws, are screws, I'm asking Chuck, are screws typically dangerous or does it depend on the kind of screws?
Typically they're not. Typically they pass through. So observation is what's generally done. And if it doesn't appear in the patient's stool within a reasonable amount of time, that being a few days, then you have to re-x-ray the patient and see whether or not that screw has lodged somewhere in the intestine or the stomach. And in that case, either an endoscopic scoping and retrieval can be attempted depending on the position and location of the screw, and patient, if very unlucky, they may need an open laparotomy to retrieve it. That's rare.
But I'm wondering if that's what happened, because I'm not going to read it out loud, but
may I ask a question?
Not from the public cannot comment except during public forum time. Sorry.
No, I'm a patient.
Patients can't comment if they're not on the committee. There's a time at the end of the meeting where public comment, you'll be able to speak for a few minutes. Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
It violates open meeting law. Oh, my concern was the patient was still very self-harming, even over at Valleywise, to the point where the ER was, I don't know if it's typical that the ER communicates while they're still working on a patient. while they're still over there, unless they're having a lot of difficulty with the patient.
It's really dependent on the situation. I think that for forensic patients, when we send them over there to, with both cases, they go with our staff in tow. So our staff will communicate back to the hospital if there's something going on. Our staff cannot engage in patient care while the individual is over at ValleyWise because it's ValleyWise's licensed space. So we're not allowed, it'd be illegal for us to engage in patient care. This individual in question though, just so the committee knows, this it was a new admission to the civil campus who had a history of DTS or danger to self, self-injurious behavior. Typically when we get folks like this into the hospital, they have about please don't quote me on this, but it's about a 2 to 3 week kind of honeymoon period, I guess, where they're trying to get situated with the environment. They do things like this to act out, to get attention. It's behavioral. And this individual has been fairly silent for at least 2 weeks at this point now. So I think they're stabilizing. But if they do anything like this ever again, we'll obviously rapidly engage to make sure that they're safe.
Okay. Thank you. The next one is Ash 2024-3756. And this one was a patient that appeared to have white substances around their nose. So I think the techs were trying to figure out what was going on and observed another white substance on the patient's sweater and other parts of their body. They thought it potentially could be laundry soap, but they were saying that there were other concerns about this patient. I think they have to be monitored because of other restrictions they have. But in the notes, it also said they have to be monitored continuously because they appear to be eating, or taking items to consume. And it had occurred then and in the past, but it said due to not enough staff, it's quite difficult and challenging to be able to monitor that patient. And the patient was refusing to eat also, which was at conflict with the patient's normal state. In the notes, it does say from nursing that the patient is having their meds, their whole psychiatric medication regime changed, which can lead to an increase in the recent psychotic symptoms as the patient adjusts. But it was a little concerning to say that they felt they didn't have enough staff to correctly monitor the patient.
Yeah, and that's obviously an ongoing battle that we have in healthcare facilities. And I'm not downplaying that comment whatsoever, but in healthcare facilities, especially in facilities such as the state hospital, staff like to have what I refer to as strength in numbers. So you can have, 20 staff on the unit with 20 patients, and things like this are going to happen. And in fact, it could actually make the situation much worse because you're putting more bodies into a confined space and then tensions rise. So it's obviously a balancing act that we do. If this individual needed anything like a constant or continuous observation status or a COS one-to-one, we would have easily put the staff on that unit to monitor this individual to make sure that they were safe at all times.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? This is Tamina.
Mm-hmm.
Was a toxicology workup completed on this patient to identify what kind of substance there was?
I can't answer that 100%, Janina, but I do believe that in this case, and Trevor, if you know more about this than I do, I believe it was like laundry powder.
Yes, they did do a UDS just to make sure that ruled out anything. And then, but again, he kept coming in and out of that laundry room. And so that's what it was assumed to be, was the laundry soap.
I mean, in this kind of situation, and I can be corrected, Dr. Goldstein, you can jump in here if you wish. I think that a toxicology workup would be warranted in addition to a UDF.
Yeah.
That's just
My
two cents.
It seems like they are aware that this individual tries to consume items and things. It didn't seem like they thought of it. The way the report was written, it would indicate they thought they found the substance when they found the laundry detergent, and they made sure that was taken back to the nurse's station. But again, I'm sure if they're changing his meds, they're monitoring his blood levels. I would.
Okay.
Larry will be back in a moment. The next one is Ash 2024-3781. And this one, unfortunately, was a fall. And the patient was showering, and then the patient ended up slipping and falling. And then kind of was laying in a fetal position and really not interacting. Their pain score was low. There was no grimacing or guarding. So the nurses reported that the person wasn't cooperating even with them trying to examine if they were injured in the fall. And then this was at 1300. So then about 25 minutes later, they called and noticed that there was blood, a quarter size wound. What must have happened in the fall. And at that time, you know, they were trying the best they could with the person not being cooperative, but when they took the vitals, they were a little bit elevated. Then they went ahead, and medical provider wanted the person sent to Valley Wise for further evaluation. They called 911. And by this point, the patient then was at least responding before they were aware, but not responding. On this one, the employee was notified of an incident for a review. Trying to see why that happened. Sorry about that. I usually highlight the things I'm going to bring up about them as I read them and collect them. Jane, you had your hand up?
Yeah, Lori, I have a question. So it was the patient refusing to cooperate and answer questions, or did they not have the capacity at that time because of the injury to answer those questions?
Yeah, great question, Jane. He was refusing.
Yeah.
And how do you make that determination?
So when this individual fell, this individual did not hit their head by any means. And this had been a previous behavioral issue of this patient in the past, where they decide to not respond to questions and lay in that fetal position. And usually pretty quickly, this individual will jump back up and start laughing about it. And so it was not uncommon.
And yet, a follow-up question, if I may.
Yeah.
And yet, in this case, this person had a quarter-size injury that was bleeding. And so, I guess, was a mental status exam done to determine mental status after a fall? Would that be the standard of care?
Yep. So they did as best of an assessment as they could with the patient who did not want to engage. The quarter size wound was on the lower extremity of their body. And so would it have caused any cognitive issues?
And what it says too in the report was that they had had this pattern of refusing to cooperate earlier in the day as well. And again, it was probably not on the visible area and that the patient was in until someone saw that there was some blood. That's when they, again, I think called the medical, the RN, and they called to check, and the PNUM and other people.
So Laurie, was he, did he have a pattern of being uncooperative, or was he cooperative or not cooperative prior to that?
Not cooperative, and hadn't been cooperative earlier in the day.
Got it.
Yeah, and they were assessing pain scale earlier and then later. Then they took vitals. It was just later when the medical provider arrived to the unit. Then the patient started to indicate that they were having some pain. And at that point, the pain scale went from 0 out of 10 to 10 out of 10. I mean, as they report on that FACES scale, which I have no idea what that is, but I'm sure it's a pain measurement scale.
This little series of faces that go from sad to looking happy, and pointed that. Now, to answer your question, Jane, I'm not sure whether there was a reading over this, and I'm reading over this for the first time. But to answer your question, I'm not sure that a mini mental exam was actually done here. In the emergency room, for example, just to determine whether somebody has the capacity to understand questions that are being asked of them, we usually ask them where they are. What time is it? Do they know where they are? Do they know who they are? And if they can answer those very simple questions, we assume they have the capacity to make a rational decision. And that in this case, the person then, if that had been assessed, which I'm kind of certain that they would have at least done that, then the person acting bizarrely could be attributed to just his behavior rather than to any kind of insult to the brain due to the fall. That's my understanding here. And I just want to point out that just because, I mean, I'm arguing against myself here, but just because somebody is not agreeable, doesn't follow orders, or won't cooperate earlier in the day, doesn't mean that after they suffer a head injury, you should assume.
This wasn't a head injury.
But I thought it was a head injury.
No, it was a fall. It wasn't a head.
That's correct, Lori. They did not hit their head. There was no.
Okay.
Did not.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then there was really no reason to assume that this person did not have capacity to understand.
Yeah.
At least from this incident, then.
Okay, so that was that one. Let me see if there's anything else.
I have my hand up, Lori, for one final question.
Sorry, Jane.
Yeah, so the patient was uncooperative when they fell, and they were initially interacting with staff. So would it not be reasonable to presume that a zero on the face scale would just be a sign of uncooperation and not a true measurement of any pain that was being experienced?
So I will do my best to answer that question, but feel free anybody else to jump in. So because this patient refused to answer questions, they were going based off of his presentation in terms of, was he, as the IR was saying, was he grimacing? Was he crying? Was anything like that to indicate that there might be pain? And initially that was not the case. And then later on, when they were again continuously reassessing him, it was determined that it looked like he was in pain based off of the facial expressions that he had.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Okay, let me see the other one. I think that is it for the reports that I pulled today, or not today, for this month. Let me see back where we are. So I'm not sure if Barb, have you joined yet? So Alice, do you want to report? And I'll give Barb a text and see if she can join.
Okay. Well, I can go over some things, but there's some things that I need to be careful of because I don't want to give away like HIPAA. And also, Mike, there are some questions that I'd like to construct for you, like I had done last month, and send you in an email, if that's okay.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. That way I can thoughtfully construct them and go through paperwork and make sure it's thorough. So one thing that I'd like to know, I still don't have an answer on, is did the autistic patient with whom we've been speaking about, did he ever get the noise-canceling headphones? It's under the ADA. When I had the meeting with this patient, I was told the patient did not.
I think the situation there was the individual did have headphones, but we determined they were contraband because they were metal. And we gave this individual the option to purchase a different brand that was approved. But what I can't say is whether or not that actually happened. Trevor, am I thinking this of the right case?
Yeah, you are. And so as Mike is saying, we did find noise canceling headphones through an approved source that would not be contraband, presented to this individual a few options, and this individual declined those options.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that a lot. Okay. So then,
hi, Alice. This is Kay. Yeah. I've spoken to that patient, and that patient hasn't received any options, actually.
Okay. That in my notes it said that they hadn't. It said in my notes it says that I still need to get an answer for that patient. Also, I'm sorry about light, because a large amount of light is another problem related to this patient's autism. And a pair of appropriate like blue blocker glasses or something, the patient said would help a lot. And then there was another concern about taste. And this makes complete sense. Because they don't have the filtration on the bottles, and I guess it's become very expensive to buy drinks or bottled water or things like that. There's a problem with the patient feeling comfortable drinking the regular tap water at the hospital due to, like I said, the issues related to his autism, the taste and texture of the water, as well as the bright lights and sound.
I want to point out that we do have water stations throughout both of our campuses, and those water stations have filtered water in them to use. It's not regular tap water that we're asking patients to drink.
So they do have filtration on those. Okay.
That is
for correct. Some reason I wasn't clear if they did or didn't. Okay. Okay, good. All right.
Yeah, they're filtered water fountains, and we're also looking at the possibility of funding permitted to install bottle filling stations on those units as well. And those are also filtered, obviously.
Oh, that would be great. I know we have those in the public school system and they're wonderful. And they are filtered and the kids can just go up and refill their bottles throughout the day. That would be great to have for the patient.
I can speak from the patient perspective. I know that the water filtration bottles that they were using were like squeezy ones. They weren't hard bottles. And the water filling stations would be great. But like I said in the previous meetings, we don't have water bottles anymore because they were said to be contraband. So even though if we get those water filling stations, I don't know what we're going to use. I guess we can use our old Mountain Dew bottles or something, but I don't know. It seems kind of futile.
I'm curious about that. Why can they have a bottle of soda and yet not a squeezy bottle of a water container with a filter? What's the difference that one's contraband and one isn't?
I don't have the answer to that, unfortunately. I think it was something to do with some patients had bottles that were like hard plastic. Even if it's kind of like, even if it's still kind of flexy, it could still be used as a weapon. Others had bottles that were actually metal, which clearly is an issue for us. I think the thought was we'll install these stations and then the patients, kind of like Kay just said, could refill a general kind of bottle of water like they would get from a vending machine and use that in rotation.
Okay. Hey, is it possible, Kay, am I able to see what the filter bottles you were talking about that were squeezy, that were soft?
Yeah, I can get you the actual name and the manufacturer and and then you can Google them. But they had, it was like a Brita style filter inside of them. They're called Seychelles. I've seen them, like a couple of patients had them. They have like a small Brita filter in them, and then you filter the water through them, and it's actually kind of a squeezy kind of bottle to drink from. It was all soft plastic. I've seen them. I don't know why those were confiscated, but they were.
Okay. I wanted to try to understand why those were confiscated over, like I said, a bottle that they can get from a vending machine of soda. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I just want to understand why one would be considered dangerous and up on.
I think security, when they did the contraband sweep, just confiscated all water bottles because some were hard, some had metal in them. Like there was just kind of a myriad of different kind of water bottles. And I think that like maybe if we can get the other ones back or at least get them approved or something, that would be helpful. I think security just kind of came through and they saw water bottle on the list and just grabbed all water bottles, not understanding which ones were contraband and which ones weren't.
It just stinks because I know that those soft filter water bottles can be very pricey. I buy that kind of stuff for when I go camping in case I run out of water on a hike, and I know they are not cheap.
Yeah, they're like $40 or something like that.
And that makes sense. Okay. All right. Then I need to know, can I get in writing, Mike, what the patient is being offered for noise canceling headphones? Is it possible? Because under the Americans with Disabilities Act, he really should have something. And if I can have a copy, and then, you know, I can let him know, and then there's like no.
Do you want a motion for a vote for that, that we'd like?
Can we do that?
I think that we can ask for a policy, the hospital policy, on how they would accommodate someone with autism or on the spectrum in regard to head canceling headsets, but not for one person in particular. I think in general.
What is the policy? in general, as well as something also for the light, because, you know, obviously light as well as sound can be very, very distressful for somebody with autism.
So
I move to get a list of the approved headphones for this patient, so that we can have a copy and then relay that information to the patient.
Not for that patient, for any patient on the
spectrum. Any patient.
Yes.
I think that's perfect. That way we can have something, yeah, in writing for any patient.
Okay. Alice, keep in mind that, you know, safety is of utmost importance in the hospital. And, you know, yes, while the ADA accommodations are warranted, you know, if those accommodations can potentially violate or endanger somebody, then, you know, we can't.
Well, and that's why he mentioned like different kinds, like in some cases, the metal is a danger. You know, in other cases, you know, Mike, you said that there were, or Trevor, that there were some that were appropriate. I would
go more along the lines that what Lori was saying regarding a policy, and you know, maybe a clarification, but versus the, you know, have Mike being sworn in and all that. I'm just kidding, but you know. So I would go more along policies and figure out how to mediate the ADA and safety.
Yeah, because I'm just concerned because this has been going on for so long. And if there's any possible way that I can help him so that he can participate more often during the day on the unit, in you know, his big thing is the sound and the light, you know, being two of his, you know, biggest reasons. And then he admits to the fact that it also leads to behavior, you know, which neurologically, I understand that. My master's is in exceptional special ed. And of course, you know, autism was one of the big focuses in my studies. And I also work with a lot of autistic students and patients. So I understand. So I just feel like, you know, do one thing that would really be great.
I mean, and obviously we'll supply the IOC with whatever we can. I don't know if we're going to have a policy that speaks specifically to what you're referring to. It could be a mixture of our contraband policy and then other types of accommodation policies that we may have. So we'll do our best to get you kind of in the wheelhouse and then go from there.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Mike, I don't expect for you to have a specific policy for headphones, you know, but that would be more regarding contraband and so forth. So that's,
Getting confused now. All I'm looking for is what was presented to this patient, because if he says he wasn't presented with anything, I would just like to see it. And then
we can schedule
a meeting with me and I can say, hey, these are what I was told you're presented with. And if you weren't, here's what I have from the hospital for you.
Yeah,
and then move forward to getting him what he needs.
Yeah, we can do some digging on that. I'll definitely get with Trevor tomorrow, and we'll upload something to the folder so you all can see exactly the evidence of what we've done.
Okay.
Perfect. And
the other thing that I was going to ask Melissa, I've been through a lot of psych facilities, visiting, touring, and I've seen lots of patients. I don't think I've ever seen ones with glasses on that were shaded or anything. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Melissa, are you aware as an architect? I know you guys do lighting that's kinder and softer and more in tune with not the bright fluorescence, but do they have approved glasses? And I mean, I would think too, in a hospital, you'd want to be able to see the person's eyes to see if how they're responding too. So I think I'm just wondering.
So there's like blue blockers. There are glasses, and I've seen students with them. Also, when I'm in a classroom where a lot of the kids are autistic, I do have specific lights that I use, and I turn off the fluorescence when they're in the classroom, and it's a huge help. But yeah, you can still see their eyes, their pupils, everything. It's usually a spectrum, like a blue blocker, lighter shade.
Lori, I'm not sure I'm understanding. Are you talking about the actual glasses an individual wears, or you're talking about the window?
That's what they're talking about. I know you do more lighting design. Are you aware of glasses that help?
Like mitigate?
Yeah.
I'm not, but it makes sense that there is. So that's, no, I'm not. Sure. I can follow up though. Yeah.
Okay. If you want to, I can probably even ask at the district level, the school district level, what they use for some of the kids, because I've seen it. And like I said, as far as lights go, and when I'm in the classroom and I have any number of autistic kids, the students are very understanding. We turn off the fluorescence and then we use different lighting. It's just a softer lighting. And it's funny because all the students across the board prefer it. But as far as on the units, obviously you can't do that. But so there are glasses that these kinds of students or patients or, persons in general can wear. And yeah, you can see their pupils and everything. You can see it. They're not like wearing regular dark sunglasses. It just helps with some of that. It's like blue blocker, I think is what it's called. I can find out.
Okay.
It's with the rise in autism. I think that those patients and students kind of have become dear to my heart. So next thing, I think we're pretty much finished with that. One of the concerns noted by a lot of the patients, and Kay can speak to this, is the reintegration. So reintegration obviously is hugely important for the patient. So part of the reintegration skills program has to do with work and then their ability to go on specific outings. And to my understanding, unfortunately, because of funding cuts to the hospital, patients aren't getting the same number of hours of work, thus not as much money. And the only reintegration offering on the outside that doesn't cost, okay, correct me if I'm wrong, is it the library?
Yes, the library, and then I believe there's some hiking activities, but not everybody can participate in those. So I think the major concern with the patients is that getting cut to 1.5 hours at minimum wage per week amounts to roughly about $22, and that's $88 a month. And that's tough for people, like especially on CRU, that have to have cell phones, have to pay for their own personal hygiene, go on their outings, as well as, you know, I mean, it's really difficult, I think. And for the Cottonwood unit, we don't have as many outings, but it's still difficult to manage on $88 a month. And I don't know. I mean, going to the library is a form of community reintegration, but I thought the goal was to go to malls and go to restaurants and do things that you normally would do on the outs, to kind of reintegrate us with, you know, talking to hostesses, waitresses, you know, cashiers and things of that nature. And so like it's really difficult, I think, on $88 to do that.
So I want to say a couple of things really quick. One, I was not aware that the outings had been limited to just the library and that they were not going to things like the mall or
We are. It's just how are we on $88? Right. That is the question. Like you've seen the place. Just going to Chipotle is like $25. Right. I mean,
so just so everybody understands how this works is that we have at the hospital what is referred to as a therapeutic work program. And the patients will engage in certain activities. And if they do so, the hospital is required by law to pay the patient's minimum wage. So minimum wage is going to increase by law in a couple of weeks here. We did an analysis and we found that there were about 90 patients on the forensic campus alone that were engaged in the therapeutic work programming, getting on average about 3 hours approximately per week. So you all can do the math. I'm not going to go into it for what that's costing, but that's coming right out of the hospital's operating fund, which we need to also spend on, you know, salaries for employees, supplies for right. the units, everything else, right? So I made a call about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago to pull that program in and reduce the amount of hours, like Kay said, to 1.5 per week per patient. I'm also going to have Trevor and his team in early January have some very thoughtful and quite frankly, curt conversations with the patients about that program. I don't believe that, so the forensic hospital has 125 patients on it approximately. I don't believe that 90 should be in the therapeutic work program. I think that it should be more selective to those individual patients who are actively engaging in treatments, they're medication compliant, they are trying to progress and move themselves forward. So once we, it really should be like work. If you have a job, you should not be assaulting other patients. You should not be aggressive towards our staff. You should not be physically assaultive towards employees. If you do that in the real world, you get fired. That's
like arrested.
Exactly. So I really want to make sure that we're targeting that program correctly for the patients who have shown that they are truly committed to the hospital and moving through this system. The way I envision it, the therapeutic work program, once we have these conversations with the patients and we have a better sense of how this thing should work, I believe that the number of hours will increase, but the number of patients in that program will decrease. I don't have more details than that right now, but that's the approach that I've asked the team to take so that we can be more conscious of the resources that we are utilizing.
Okay, it's just, our argument is that it's just going to be difficult for the outing to do all of that on $88 a month. That's all, that's our only complaint.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Kay. And if you think about it, if a patient has privileges for outings, then they should be in the therapeutic work program getting a few hours of work per week, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. And I think in general, like the way that the work program works here is that if you've gotten into fights or if you've, you know, caused problems with staff, like they generally pull you from the work program. You're not available to work. It's normally on the treatment team to suggest to rehab who is ready to be part of the work program. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's a treatment team decision, and it's not based on anybody in rehab. Like the treatment team makes the referral, and the treatment team is ultimately the one that is, you know, assuring that they are medication compliant, that they aren't getting into fights, they are doing what they're supposed to be doing, and then they make the recommendation to rehab. That's currently what's in place.
Yeah. And I just want to make it to be more of, I want to emphasize the work part of it, and maybe, I don't want to say de-emphasize, but not lean so heavily on the therapeutic part of it. I really do believe that, you know, Kay, you and your colleagues, at some point you're going to discharge and you're going to go out into the real world. And the real world, will not tolerate people who, you know, kind of act a fool. So that's kind of more of the emphasis that I want to put on this, but this is really a moving target at this point. But just know this is not a indefinite forever kind of thing right here. We're looking at the program holistically and how to reformat it to better serve you as patients and still be respectful of our limited resources.
Okay, yeah, I know. And we've, as patients, have come up with some ideas to help, you know, offset some of the costs. And we can have those discussions later. But I just wanted to address the complaints and why people are struggling.
Yeah, if I can comment on that also, and I'm not saying that 100% of it comes.
No.
Huh?
If you're a patient, you cannot talk at this point. Kay can talk because she's part of the IOC. Sorry.
Okay, so I just have a quick just interjection. I'm probably going to be hated for this. You say a person cannot act the fool in the community when they have a job. They can't physically get violent, verbally. They shouldn't have to, like, not unlike a violent patient on a unit, be held back in a hold, a CPI hold, going after another patient, you know, going after people within their care. Just, you know, that's something else that we need to address, but I think we should address it in executive meeting. So you guys can kick me off if you want, but.
No, I mean, again, I think that.
Alice, can you explain a little bit more? Because I'm trying to understand.
I don't want to end up getting another target on my back or something for saying something. I'm not getting another phone call from somebody threatening me. Nope, not going to happen. Video that we watched, and I can't say this publicly because I will not be threatened again.
Okay. Understood, okay. But no one should be threatened volunteer work and standing up for someone's human rights. So that's just wrong.
Exactly. So somebody else is going to need to do it, but I think that it should be addressed.
And I was just going to say too, that even in the, on the outside, in the supported work programs, even if you have an SMI diagnosis and you're in a supported work program, if you're having symptoms of your mental illness and you need to leave work, that's kind of understood. Or if you need help communicating challenges that you're having or in the work, that's understood, but you cannot just say, I want to leave now, I'm tired or I'm bored or this or that, or even that comes to an end. So I do think that there has to be some realistic expectations when people are planning and prepping for the real world and for work.
So Lori, I agree with you. And what I heard, and now this is my opinion. So if somebody is eligible for a work program, they should not have DTO or DTS behavior whatsoever. And the risk of them having such thoughts or actions and et cetera should be extremely low, or just no risk for that, because otherwise, you know, we're setting them up. I mean, not we, but they're set up for failure, right? Because you know, in the real world, there are rules, regulations, vital norms, et cetera, that people have to follow, whether you have a mental illness or not. And if they have to, if they want to be part of a meaningful employment program or whatever, they need to be safe and, you know, give reassurance that the people around them are safe. Does that make sense?
It makes sense not only for them, but they may jeopardize the program, because employers enter into this relationship, an agreement with certain behavioral health providers, with the understanding that their staff and their clients are going to be safe, right? So if you allow someone that's not going to follow the rules or be safe, that jeopardizes it, the whole program for everyone.
Right, and it puts in the danger the other participants in the program.
Yeah,
which is not, it's not fair. And it violates their rights.
Agree.
So, yeah.
We agree. So, Alice, I know Barb is on. Barb, were you able to unmute? Now, Larry, you're the moderator. I'm not the moderator. I don't know if you're allowed or you have the authority to unmute anyone. I know in other meetings I can't unmute. I can mute people, but I can't unmute.
That's correct. I have the same thing as well. I can't unmute people. Star 6 will unmute if you're still on the call.
So Barb, try star 6.
Am I did. Alice. Can you hear me now?
Barb?
We can hear you.
Yeah. I tried. Oh, good. Good. Thank you, Larry. Thank you. So are you wanting me to go on with the patient visits?
Well, you and Alice, you guys choose.
Well, we had asked that, as Alice had said, that we bring some of this up in the executive session, but we have to wait to get that on the agenda, because there's too many identifiable things that we could say that would easily identify patients, and we don't want them that to happen.
To protect
their privacy. But one of the things that, you know, there's a couple of things that were kind of throughout, maybe not every single one that we saw, but a number of the patients questioned, you know, if ASH is supposed to be to emulate the outside society, why is it that they're treated better? It's less restrictive and they're treated better when they're in jail. So that, you know, that they'd actually rather be in jail because so many things are so much better. And yes, the headphone incident, we've already talked about. And you know, the other thing about keeping going in executive session is so there won't be retaliation. Again, it's, you know, walking horse, which is seems to come up at almost all the time in terms of patients, you know, wanting to have some of their other company available. And I from being in all the meetings before, I don't think that's going to happen. And just the, you know, one of the things about, as Alice said, there are definitely sensory issues involved with people on the spectrum. And light and noise are two of the biggest ones. Another one is tags on clothing or seams on socks. So, you know, you need to meet the patient where they are. Then what's, you know, there's just some patients who didn't understand they got nailed on some things, why that what they did was, you know, wasn't, that they got docked for or dinged for. So, I know what it was. When they go, they have more privileges at DOC and they get time served, whereas ASHTA, they don't give them any credit for the time served.
One thing, Barbara, I can say is that typically, I mean, if someone is at ASH and they've had a plea agreement that they go to ASH, it's a different environment than jail and prison. I do know of cases, recent cases, where people that we all know, attorneys, that had been contacted after the fact, and patients that are very SMI, and you guys know some of them as well, that weren't as fortunate to go to ASH and went to jail or prison, and some of them died, and others are really, even the attorneys are saying, I'm like, well, why are they going to prison if this happened? Well, it was their lawyer that they maintained that didn't ask for a plea. So again, the assertion that things are always better in prison, I'm hearing from attorneys that don't always think that. And even our old IOC member, Ashley Odo, who's now general counsel and associate deputy attorney over our prison systems. I don't know if, you know, they try to do the best they can in prisons. I don't think it's as therapeutic as a hospital.
Lori, I agree with you. And this is Janina. so I do coordinate care with the jail system quite often, and the care in the DOC and jail is poor at best. They're not getting medications, they're not getting treatment, they're not getting anything. So that statement is really
I was just reporting what I heard from a couple of the patients.
Okay.
I didn't say that it's true.
Can I jump in really quick? I know that the back time issue is something that's clearly written in the law. The law says that we do not get the back time if we do take a GEI plea to ASH. So unless they are willing to transfer to the Department of Corrections, in which they can get their back time, that's the only way that they can actually get their back time.
Thank you, Kay. Okay. The other thing that came up that sometimes comes up is snacks. Some of the patients want healthier snacks, and one of the patients expressed that He was hungry all the time because he moves around a lot, exercises and stuff, and he can't get anything. I asked him if he talked to the RD, and he told me that she or he had told him that the budget was cut. So, and I don't believe, I can understand that the patient is hungry. However, on the exterior, he looks fit. He doesn't look gaunt. He doesn't look like, you know, he's not weighing what he should be, or, you know, having trouble getting around. So, but I can understand the hunger.
Yeah, it's got to be very frustrating. I felt that from him too, Barb. And the fact being that, you know, when you look at things like, essentially he compared it to commissary, you know, if he was in jail or prison, it's more expensive at the state hospital. And the other thing is,
right,
these guys should be able to access more quality food. And I am very happy about some of the coming changes across the nation. Every time I travel in Europe or other countries, I feel healthy within a week. Well, I didn't realize it until about 5 years ago. It's because there's so much toxicity in these processed foods we eat here. Well, mental health, right, and physical health are tied together. So,
right, diet is definitely tied to behavioral health, mental health. And the fact that is that when you're in an institutional setting, many of the times, because of budgetary issues, healthier food can't be provided. So it's like the junk that's the ultra processed foods that are put in the machines or are available to buy.
Yeah, and hot dogs, you know, are fed to them at night. And yet, you know what? It's like some of these long-acting injections are $30,000. That's such a wow. Even
I think
diet alone could be very helpful. You know what I mean?
There's research out that people who have bipolar disorder can do well. Their symptoms are improved being on the keto diet. But the keto diet is not necessarily, it's not necessarily the easiest for people to be on or to be on long term.
I think Mike had his hand up.
This is Nina. If you don't mind, Alice and Bart and everybody from ISC, can we maybe take this offline and have a cohesive a message to the leadership at ASH, because I think we're
already mentioned that we should definitely take some of this to executive committee. Agree, Janina.
Yeah, Mike has his hand up. Mike?
Thanks, Lori and members. I want to just make it very clear that the hospital has not cut food services to any patient due to funding at all. That would be the last thing we would ever do. If you're being told we cut the food services to the patients, that is absolutely 100% false.
Okay.
One thing I heard in different meetings, and Mike, it wasn't you, but some of your staff were in the meetings as well. When patients in the forums, and I've been on both civil and forensic, when they've asked for healthier forums, I do think that it was on civil, and it was explained that when the vendors put in healthier options, the vendors that are contracted don't like it when the healthier options don't sell. And when they don't sell, people say they want to be healthier and eat healthier, but their behavior and practices, if they don't buy those healthier snacks and they go after the other snacks, then the vendors stop stocking them or stock them at a much lower rate. So it's kind of this self-fulfilling prophecy. People will say, I want to eat healthier, but then they go to the machine mm-hmm. and they choose junk, right?
That's 100% true. It's all supply and demand. The food that gets put in those machines, right. It does spoil eventually. So the vendors are operating at a loss to put that into the machines, unfortunately. Well,
my question was a little bit further, and that had to do with, does Walking Horse offer food? Because one of the patient's concerns was that they weren't able to buy some of the food from Walking Horse, and I wasn't sure if they offered healthy options.
Walking Horse does offer food. However, my understanding is that we do not allow patients to purchase food from Walking Horse, specifically because I cannot have patients hoarding food in their rooms. And essentially what will happen, and I can promise you it will happen because it's happened before, is that patients will buy things and then sell them to other patients and kind of exploit their colleagues. And then, you know, I can't have patients running a store out of their bedroom.
Then I see what's going on. Okay. That's when I kind of needed a full picture.
Yeah, I agree.
Any other major concerns?
Was that all right?
I was just saying, any other major concerns from the patient visits, any topics that can be brought up here rather than executive session?
Sorry. I think we've already pretty much said what we can say here. Do you agree, Alice?
Yeah, I agree. Thanks, Barb.
Thank you, guys. Were you able to go over to the civil side and set up a table?
No, we just had the patient names that we had were all from forensic.
Yeah. Well, anytime you want to go, I think even though the civil patients don't tend to sign up like they had years ago, I know when we're there in the forums, then they want to talk. So we were thinking that next time people had time to go visit the hospital, if you go visit forensics, if you want to take an hour and maybe set up in the library or somewhere on the civil side, patients, you'd get a perspective of the civil campus patients' wants and desires as well.
Okay. I'm substitute teaching and substitute nursing in the districts right now, enjoying the kids. So my schedule's super flexible. If anybody's got time, I'm glad to do it again.
Okay.
As would I.
I can join Alice on a Monday.
On Monday?
Yeah. Monday is my cycle, so I can join you.
Okay.
That'd be fabulous, Janina.
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
Okay, guys. Cool. Let's see. We have a couple things. One, I think, Larry, they would like to talk about some of the issues in executive session. We could go call to the public, executive session, then back to the public meeting to adjourn. Do we have, I don't know if we had planned on it, so I don't know if we have the executive session link.
Lori, we don't have it on the agenda.
Okay.
It would have to be tabled for next month.
Okay, we can do that. And the other thing is I did send you guys the list that IOC, it's a risk assessment readiness checklist. So in your inboxes, it has all of the items that are required before someone is going to get a request for a risk assessment. So there's let's see, 24 items that need to be, I think probably positive before they can go forward for an assessment. One thing, Mike, are those shared with the patients? Do they know what they have to commit or what they have to show and demonstrate?
So I think that policy was just approved in the past 7 or 10 days. I don't believe we have shared that with them yet. I could be wrong, but if we haven't, and I'm probably safe to say that we have not. So we'll figure out a way to do that. I don't know if we'll post it on the unit or just hand out a couple of copies to every unit so they all have it. There's nothing on that list that is like groundbreaking, you know, make you panic. It's basically the stuff that we've already discussed. You know, does the individual take their medications? Have they had any instances of abusive, assaultive behavior? Do they understand the symptoms of their mental illness? You know, things like that. So we have no problem sharing it. I made it very clear that the patients need to know what we're going to be assessing them against before we dedicate our resources for a risk assessment, because ultimately what's going to happen is if we move forward with a risk assessment and the patient's lawyer files a petition to go to court to have the their privileges adjusted, the judge is going to look at the risk assessment and he or she is going to say, well, wait, this person's not taking their medications. Why would you even bother recommending them for privileges? So it's basically just it's just a checklist to make sure that we don't expend resources unnecessarily and then bog down the court with improper recommendations for progression. But yeah, absolutely, we'll share it with the patients. Probably get it out tomorrow, as far as I'm concerned.
Hi, Lori. I didn't get a copy. And then Mike, I have a question for you. How long do you foresee adding these extra steps will add to the risk assessment process?
I don't think it's going to add that long, Kay. I know there's already numerous assessments in the process right now that psychology is digging into. What I kind of foresee happening is that there will be an initial bottleneck as the treatment teams are going through the checklist just to verify that the individual or the patient in question has met these standards before they move forward. And then once that's taken care of, it'll be just smooth sailing through the process. And they have started risk assessments again. I don't know if we had that conversation. They restarted on December 2nd.
Good to know. And then Lori, I didn't get a copy because I know it sounds like you guys send it out by email, and obviously I don't have email. So if I can get a copy from Tara, that would be great.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get it distributed out for you all. Okay.
Yeah, the only ones I reviewed them just quickly. What if the person was in a psychotic state and can't remember their offense? Because there are some questions. Some of them make perfect sense of, are they compliant? Are they taking their medication? Are they assaultive? Do they have a positive UDS? But some of them are related to their acts and their offense. If they don't remember their offense, there's a yes, no. One of them has a yes, no, not applicable. If they can't remember their offense because they were psychotic, but they are compliant now, do they have to say yes or they can't move on?
No. So, and I think that's very important, is that it is not, you must get 100% on this checklist. This is the basic standard that we're asking the treatment teams to assess before they ask psychology to dedicate 100+ hours to do a risk assessment. So the answer to that question is no, you do not need to score 100% on that risk assessment. The way it works, folks, is that the treatment team completes this screening activity, and then they will send it to our CMO and then to me for final approval. And I said that wrong. I apologize. No, I think I said that right. It's a brand new process. I apologize. It goes to the SCC, the Special Classification Committee on Forensics. They'll review it, and then they will approve it or deny it based on the findings. They'll send it to me, and then I will be the one who says, yes, you can proceed with the risk assessment. So it's not, like I said, 100%, you must be, you know, check every single box. But because of the fact that our psychology team is so small, and we have such a heavy workload right now, that I want to make sure that they're not going to expend a ton of resources on a risk assessment for an individual who most likely is going to get denied by the courts.
I'm not a lawyer, Mike, but I did read the statutes, and like the courts are requesting medical reports, not full-blown risk assessments. They like risk assessments, it said in there, but it's not required. Is there a reason why the hospital is doing more than they need to, like legally, I guess?
We've been asked to. Okay, so the mental health report that's cited in statute essentially includes the same information that would be in a risk assessment. So that's the route we've been going down, or the road we've been going down.
Okay.
And I think with the Superior Court taking over, they were asking for more to make sure that there weren't people that were released conditionally that fail and come back, or are out in the community and commit further offenses.
That's my understanding as well.
Okay, do we have any other business before we go to public forum? Happy holidays. Okay, so we are now in public forum. So everyone, anyone in public forum, you can say whether you want your name in the minutes or not. And remember that we're not allowed to engage or interact. So if you're asking questions, we cannot respond. We'll try to keep it 3 minutes a person. And remember, don't talk about your specific treatment, but general issues that you're seeing or concerns, human rights concerns that you have. Do we have anyone that would like to talk to the IOC?
No, not on our end. Not on our end, thank you.
Okay. Any other public comment? Okay. Hearing none, do I have a motion to adjourn? And we'll try to coordinate another patient visit on site on a Monday.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. Everyone have a wonderful holiday, and hopefully we'll see each other soon.
You as well. Take care, everyone.
All right. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays,
guys.
Happy holidays. Bye. Bye.